And good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming on this day. Let me go ahead and do a screen share. I thought it might be helpful to give a little bit of context to this research because I'm not sure how familiar you guys are. Also, I do have the chat open. And I might switch back and forth between my deck and the presentation on the report. So if you've got a question or something, just put a notice in the chat or bust in voice wise, cause I'm not monitoring the Zoom room. So let's see. Okay. So probably you guys don't know very much about me. Very short intro. I have my own strategic intelligence consultancy called The Purple Tornado. I've been running that since 2006, and I'm primarily a writer and researcher, both of research for government, private sector, and writing about security and digital identity for like normal consumer-based folks. Those are some of the books I've written: the Cybertech Survival Manual and Comprehensive Guide to Self-Sovereign Identity, which is about decentralized identifiers and verifiable credentials. A little bit of background on this research. I'm going to be referring to two reports. This was a 12-month program. My company won a research award from DHS Cybersecurity Division, and you can download both those reports. The first report was this blue one, Entities, Identities, and Registries. And really the question, you know, what we were told to go out and look for is what are the market gaps in digital identity in banking and finance? And so we identified 11 market gaps, which I'll touch on in a moment. And based on the results of that research, we were asked to then drill down into tracking and auditing on the supply chain, which was the result. This green report, sensors, identifiers, and digital twins, where we did a deep dive on tracking identity on the supply chain. These reports were funded by DHS, so they are public and they're available. So once I completed the work, I've been really trying to socialize them, share the information broadly so that we can all benefit from the research. As I was doing this research, one of the big things that came up was there are just going to be billions and billions of identities. And I have worked in the digital identity space for more than a decade, and that has primarily been focused on human-based identity. But this first report we did really looked at non-human entity identity, which includes companies, IoT objects, tracking of dumb things like your UPS or FedEx shipments, robots, which could be robots in a factory, or drones. It also includes data that is collected from sensors, but also might want to be shared along a supply chain or with other folks, and other kinds of information. Like, for example, I've seen some folks use digital identity and explore using decentralized identifiers to prove provenance of media for disinformation. So I was really curious, like, how many identities are we really looking at? And a couple of weeks, like in January, I gave part of this deck at the M3WAAG conference, which is a very super geeky conference where they focus on malware and mobile and abuse. And you know, most of the focus has been on human-centered abuse. And so I was just curious, like, what are we looking at for the scope? And, you know, some of the numbers I found was 128 billion identities by 2030. We haven't developed digital identity systems or paradigms for thinking about digital identity to deal with identity on that scale. So I want to just do a quick kind of overview of what is a non-person entity identity, because when I did this research, people don't usually use this term. It's used in very particular silos, like in the legal, banking, and finance, you have a legal entity that they talk about, which is a company. In when I interviewed folks at IBM, they talked about things as an IoT device. And then I also found a legacy identity, a legacy definition that is a system or something that works on, runs on a network that, and so we're not really going to, our research didn't really focus on the system stuff at all. We really focus on company and thing. And most people outside of their particular industry don't really think about what an NPE is in general. And I think that it can be useful for us to think about this, especially as we deal with the problem of, or the opportunity of, these almost 130 billion identities and what that means for our systems. Like human identity, NPE identity is given. And it's really interesting to see that basically, this is just an example of like getting a corporate identity. You have at least two people, or maybe not two people, you have people coming together, putting together articles of incorporation, registering it with the Secretary of State or whatever government entity that where you register it, and then that identity is assigned. And then that identity is then used to get other identities. And so I think this is really important to think about as we figure out, like, how are we going to use identities? How should we develop the systems? And how do they interrelate with each other? Because these identities are not created in a silo. They're within in specific contexts that include both government contexts and private sector contexts. And then when I talk about the supply chain research, there's also interest in, you know, consumer-based knowledge, your consumer context of wanting to use this information. I kind of touched on that already. I thought maybe you guys would be interested to know why would government, DHS, why do they care about it? Well, governments have a relationship with giving these identities. In this point, governments give legal entities identities. We don't really have this the exact type of same thing for IoT things or devices. And that's one of the gaps we identified. This legal identity is really important for a lot of different industries, for KYC, AML, to combat money laundering, fraud. If you are shipping goods in the supply chain across borders or multiple jurisdictions, you've got to provide different identity information. And the Internet of Things is growing exponentially. And there's two aspects of that. Well, there's probably more aspects of it, but in this case, two aspects. It's the security of the sensors, knowing that that sensor is what it says it is, and then being able to trust the data that that sensor is collecting. So this is another area that folks within the decentralized identity community are looking at as a way to know that I can trust both that sensor, but I can also trust the data of that sensor as well. And that's important because who's responsible when something goes wrong? And that was one of the gaps we did find, was who is responsible when a non-human entity, something goes wrong, whether it's a sensor or a self-driving car, or whether it's an autonomous robot that is owned by a legal entity. And the responsibility always ends up falling back on the human at some point. Humans take actions for NPEs, like you have a human that is like a CFO or your financial person, and they're the ones who are authorizing the transfer of like $40 billion for a transaction. You got to make sure that that hasn't been penetrated by, you know, someone doing CEO fraud, that you know that you can trust that the end point of that is where it's supposed to go. And then you also have NPEs taking action for humans. For example, if you have sensors in either factories or your home, like the Nest is really easy, you know, you program it, you tell it to do these things based on these variables, and it will take action for you. And then there's data collection. Just want to do a check-in. Any questions or anything about any of that information before I go into the market gap section?
Some folks have joined since you started. Can you just identify what an MPE is again?
Yeah, sure. I'll just pop back. Great. Okay, so a non-person entity identity is basically an identity that is not human related. It can be a company or a legal entity. This is important with banking and finance. It could be a thing, which is an IoT device, or also NPE identity can be used to track like things that are shipped in the shipping industry. And the legacy definition of it also is a system. But we didn't focus on this system definition at all in our research. We were focused on company and the IoT thing device. And then the other point I'll just make is that NPE identities are given the identity from mostly a government agency. In the case of the legal identity, like a corporate, if you're starting a company, a corporation, you've got to fill out your articles of incorporation and then submit it to whichever appropriate Secretary of State or other entity, depending on which jurisdiction you're in. And then once they review that, and they will give you that identity, and then that identity is like an anchor that can be used to get other identities that you can use in business. Great. Okay, so I just wanted to touch on some of the market gaps from the first report we did. I'm not going to go too deep into them, but we found 11 market gaps, 6 that had to do with corporate or legal identity, and 5 that had to do with IoT identity. And you'll see here number 2, tracking and auditing in the supply chain. And when we presented this report, our the person we were doing the research for, he was like, okay, that's really interesting. Why don't you go dig into that? So that's what we ended up doing. I forgot I put the slide in. I guess basically, like, I just kind of wanted to focus on a bit more the IoT gaps and what the opportunity is. I'm going to go through these in a moment, but basically, if you look at the sensors, identifiers, and the blue report, the NPE report, any of these market gaps mean that there are opportunities for the private sector to develop products or services that address these needs. And in some cases, the market partially addresses the needs, but they're either so expensive that they're not able to be applied broadly in the case of IoT security standards or data integrity in a military environment. Clearly, that is a must-have. But in the private sector, the costs are so high that we're not able to apply those broadly yet. So you can see there's opportunities to solve these market gaps. So one of the ways this report can be used is as evidence if you are looking to get funding or support for your project or your ideas that fit in one of these buckets. I'm just going to go over some of these high level. The first IoT gap has to do with legal identity. And when I explained the corporate identity, like, or the legal identity of a corporation, a government gives that identity. There's not the same thing for IoT identities. Now, some companies will give it as part of the manufacturing process. There are organizations and companies that put different identifiers on an IoT device, but we don't have anything that is the same as a legal, like as a Secretary of State or a government entity that, gives an identity to an IoT object. Number 2 is tracking audio on supply chain. So I'm going to go into that a little bit more. IoT security standards, this has to do with securing the IoT devices, since IoT devices are developed quickly to get to market. They don't necessarily use best practices. NIST has actually some really good guidelines for security best practices, but it's very inconsistent on whether they are actually followed or used, because it's a challenge. Like the challenge is between, can I get something to market and sell it versus, you know, really doing robust security. And I really like this quote by Bruce Schneier. If you're interested in security and IoT and you haven't read Click Here to Kill Everyone, I highly recommend it. If you follow what's happening in the industry, you probably know it all already, but he uses the term Internet Plus to describe like Industry 4.0 or Web 3.0 or various things. But it's basically this whole idea of the internet that has connected smart devices that are doing things for us and maybe autonomously doing things. And what's really interesting is that he's really calling for some government oversight, some regulations. And I gotta admit, I'm kind of a fan of that, because I really truly do not believe that private sector will self-regulate themselves. If you look at the state of IoT security, you know, they have an opportunity, companies developing this stuff have an opportunity to build more robust security into their devices, but it doesn't make sense from a market capitalist perspective. And how do you get someone to comply in that kind of case? Well, you have to come up with some kinds of regulations. And I don't believe the regulations need to be particularly onerous. They need to make sense, and they need to be able to be complied with. And companies still need to make money. So, you know, but we also need to ensure that there is security so that these don't become a bigger security risk and a problem in the future. IoT, so I guess gaps 3, 4, and 5 really are kind of like different aspects of a very similar problem. We just wanted to extract them out and be very explicit about the specific thing we meant. So IoT self-authentication is that the device can authenticate itself on the system. And again, there is technology that exists to do this. But the reason we added this as a gap was that it's challenging, it's costly to implement it and integrate it. And so, you know, we would like to see the cost of this implementation to go down so that we can have more security within the IoT networks. A slight aspect of that has to do with data integrity from the IoT sensors. Again, this is, you need to trust the sensor and you need to trust the data coming off the sensor. And this is really important when you're talking about supply chain. If you're putting like an IoT sensor, like the sensors that say like Zest Labs develops. So you need to know that, okay, I can trust that, you know, this sensor that's put in with this basket of fresh produce, that it's tracking whatever kind of temperature, that I can trust that the sensor is what it says it is and is where it says it is, but then also that the data coming off it can't be spoofed. Okay, just checking in before I go into some supply chain stuff. Any questions? Great. I wanted to share that information beforehand because this report, you know, I was originally thinking I would just like dig in and maybe give you guys a curated view of this report. But I thought it would be helpful for you guys to understand the context in which this information occurred, because it's not in a vacuum. And, you know, I did speak with and interview some of the other folks that you've had present here, and I am familiar with some of the folks and the work in the space. Oops. All right. So digital twins and asset passports, these are not going to probably be surprising to anyone here, but the whole idea is that you've got something and then you've got a sensor that is associated with this, and you want to collect data along its, you know, journey. And we've got this concept of a digital twin, which is the digital anchor of the physical item, and then to be able to attach data associated with it. Now, I also came across this really interesting concept by Vinay Gupta called an asset passport. And this is this idea, and he really uses it more in the case of like, I think, you know, like selling objects. Like he's applied it to a violin. But I think the concept is interesting and can potentially be applied across supply chain as well, which basically is like you're collecting data, but versus like collecting it in like a digital twin with like all the data together, you're actually like collecting the information in more of a linear form as it goes through the journey. And the idea is that the data can be certified at different places along the journey and could potentially be shared. But then the larger vision is that there could be a smart contract or other kind of financial transaction that could automagically occur. For example, if say you have like a shipping container that is received at Port of Long Beach, and it's got sensors, and you're able to, in addition to other data that's collected, see that shipping container is being moved through customs, or now it's on a truck, and you could be tracking where the truck is going, and when that physical object changes the physical location, you could activate certain financial transactions where funding would otherwise be held in escrow. That is kind of a very futuristic view, but you know, I think it's useful to think about it. I kind of found like three major trends in supply chain, and those had to do with digitization, general standards, and regulations. And
Heather, I have one question. Yeah. Excuse me. So in my space, we're doing a digitalization of the entire globe one street at a time. I find this interesting that perhaps we could make a entity of a building, because my obsession Ooh. Or my focus is geolocation.
Yeah.
I know, right?
Okay, that's really cool.
Definitely. And then, please, you are going to forward your papers, right?
Well, I'm happy to forward them. But you guys are also you feel free to download them.
Okay.
I'll just put here. You know what I'll do is I will. Let me just grab these. And I'll put them in. Oops. Oh my God, like I'm totally having anyone else's computer's not working. There we go. So I will say when you these front pages, they're to me, they're just so I can monitor how many times these have been downloaded. I'm not gonna spam you with stuff. I also do a lot of other research and similar stuff, so I like to share what it is. So I ask for your name and email, but you can immediately unsubscribe. And I'm not like a crazy marketer spammer person. I'm like a introvert researcher. So just letting you know, but you guys, I put the links on the, in the group chat. So the NPE report is this blue one. And the supply chain report is the green one. Okay. Anyway, that was that you, Marco, who said that? I wasn't really sure who talked.
That was Brett. But yeah, Brett, at the end. Go ahead.
So this is one of the reasons why I like to share my work, is because clearly I would have never thought about making a building be an entity, but that makes perfect sense.
It totally does.
And here, I think this also brings up another thing we need to think about. It's like, we're going to have groups and nested identities that are together. Like, I mean, some people who have smart homes have already kind of opined about this a little bit. If you have a smart home and like two people are living in it, who owns those devices? Because right now we really only have like this paradigm of where like one human attached to the IoT device. We don't have like complex interrelated human NPE identity, not even like at a smart home level. And so I can just imagine the complexity at a building level, but I can also imagine like how that could open so many other possibilities for, you know, tracking or collecting information, in both like in all kinds of different use cases, as long as it's not too creepy and surveillance-y like, you know. Cool. Okay, so I want to just like touch on some of these current trends.
Chuckles. I chuckled.
Oh, okay, great. And I'm probably going to skip back and forth between the deck and the presentation now, because my deck is pretty, I didn't want to copy everything into a presentation. One of the things that was really interesting when we talked about the digitization is there's kind of like two levels of digitization happening in supply chain. And one was like, hey, let's just put it into an Excel spreadsheet versus paper, right? Moving to using computers versus printouts and handwritten and signatures and stuff like that. But then there's the next level, which is actually extracting the data out of either the paper or the Excel file or spreadsheet or PDF. And of course, you guys, a lot of different folks use EDI, but I think there's also this opportunity to make this type of data more interoperable or more fluid. So I'm not holding my breath that that is going to happen overnight in the supply chain industry, but I know that that is something that a lot of companies would like, although it is extremely challenging because supply chain is not, there's like no one leader in the industry that can say, hey, I'm going to, you know, make this happen, because supply chain crosses so many different jurisdictions. And that's something that kind of comes up over and over. And even with the NPE stuff is, this is just part of what it's like to live in our global world today. We have different countries with different jurisdictions. When I did a deep dive into oil and gas, just learning, you know, oil pipelines, whether they're crossing state lines or you know, going to Canada to US, you know, there's a lot of different jurisdictions. And as things pass through the jurisdictions, it's very challenging. And the reason these jurisdictions are challenging is because you have different labor standards in these different jurisdictions, and you have different regulations in these different jurisdictions. And so if you're trying to do business across multiple jurisdictions, you have to comply with all the rules and regulations of all of those jurisdictions, which is just a real kind of regulation nightmare. It's a lot of overhead for those organizations that are dealing with those you know, global supply chains. I wanted to share, I did a little bit of a deep dive. You know, one of the reasons I think DHS wanted me to look into some of this stuff was to try to solve the problem, and I'm air quoting here, of IP infringement. And I'm actually doing some other research right now about espionage and trade secrets right now. So, you know, in the US, we really have this culture of property and how we want to protect property and we want to protect IP. And China and Asian factories, China's factory to the world, they have this reputation for not respecting Western IP laws. And so I was really like Like, I'm a trained futurist, so I think about things a little bit differently. And I thought, well, clearly the way we're trying to solve this IP infringement issue is not solving, and it will never be solved, because I had this gut feeling that it was possibly a cultural aspect. And so I did this deep dive for a few days, this research into what I call Shanzai, which is the culture of counterfeiting. And I actually later interviewed and wrote a piece with Bunny Huang, who wrote these rules. And I just kind of highlighted them here a little bit. And the main takeaway is that in the US and in Western countries, we develop IP and we want to secure that IP, but then we need to have someone to go produce it and make it real. And, you know, Asian factories are saying, hey, yes, we can produce this and we can make this, but they need to also innovate and problem solve when they are manufacturing new things. And the Asian culture, it comes out of Confucianism. And so there's this whole idea of Guanji, which, where did I have it in here? It's like down... Okay, I don't think I wrote about it in here. Guanji, here, number 6. Guanji is this intangible relationship that you have. It's kind of like the network effect, or, you know, we all have our professional network that if we've got an issue that we can go to and they can help problem solve it. Well, you know, Asian manufacturers have the same thing. And so they're very liberal with this whole idea of like, hey, I'm building this thing. I'm having trouble with this. How could I solve this? And so what they end up doing is these manufacturers innovate on the manufacturing side through shared knowledge on that side. But when we look at it from a Western perspective, we're like, oh, there's IP infringement. They've shared IP with other people who didn't sign non-disclosures, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just think that, you know, one of the real takeaways I had from my research was, these different views about intellectual property and how to protect it and how to innovate in the supply chain. And I don't necessarily know what the solution is, but I know that the way we're trying to solve IP infringement today will not work, because it doesn't work within the culture. And there actually is value to have Asian manufacturers share IP, because they are innovating in ways that can't be innovated in the Western world. I'm going to go back into the deck here, because I think this is a little bit bigger. So I was actually kind of new to researching the supply chain, and like anything I research new, I just like get like a bulldog and just like go way down the rabbit hole to see, to really understand it. So one of the first things I wanted to understand was this linear supply chain. And as you all know, this is a very simplified view of it. Collapsing this upstream supply chain into these two buckets is kind of amusing, but you know, you have to be simplistic to be able to explain these things. Again, look, I was coming at this from an identity data researcher perspective. And in the upstream world, you're both collecting raw material and you're refining this material, and there can be a lot of different steps in between. And there's really interesting data that is collected in these places from different people and also at different levels of technology expertise. And the data that is associated with these upstream steps is very important and interesting to the consumer. And it can be the difference between paying $10 for an item versus $1 for an item. And the consumer needs to know that they can trust that, you know, the thing they're paying $10 for really is organic or fair trade or whatever. This goes back to being able to trust the data off either the sensors or along the supply chain. If as an end consumer, I can say, okay, I have the choice of, if a consumer only has the price to make their decision on, they're going to choose the cheaper version because that makes sense. But if in realizing that the cheaper version actually, you know, your cheaper cotton t-shirt has exploited the Ural Sea and maybe it's been you know, died with the river of the effluent going into the Ganges River, you know, maybe they will decide, the consumer will decide to buy the $10 t-shirt or $20 or $50 t-shirt versus the $3 t-shirt on Amazon. But it can't just be like greenwashing. You really need to know that you can trust that data and that information. Now, I think it's also, this data is really important to other folks along the supply chain as well, to retailers. And one of the other trends I found is when it comes with millennials and Gen Zs, they really do make a decision based on, you know, these types of decisions. It's not just based on price. And also really important to the end of life has to do with whether it is can actually be recycled or not. All right, I engaged a colleague of mine who's been in the fashion industry for like 30 plus years to talk about, you know, like how do you, clothing is one of the things that gets thrown away and has such a massive environmental impact on the world. And that's because we don't actually know the information, the upstream information very well to be able to recycle it downstream. Like here, it's this idea of a circular supply chain where the way we have it before, currently, if we look at the linear supply chain, we like start with raw material, we refine it, it goes to the retailer, consumer uses it, and either gets thrown, consumed, and this is like cereal, of course, is consumed, or sometimes things are just thrown away, or they can be recycled. And so one of the things, kind of probably one of my favorite things that I saw about this research was this opportunity to have what's called, what I call is a persistent identifier. Well, right now we have identifiers across these different steps in the supply chain, but the big one, the one where all the information gets back to the consumer, like the tag, the hang tag, that doesn't stay with the product. So the consumer rips that off and you don't know if this is a 100% cotton shirt or cotton, you know, Lycra or what, and there's different recycling opportunities based on what this thing is made out of. This can also be applied to electronics, and, you know, other types of goods that could either be, repurposed. And the real goal here is to, I love this quote by Patagonia CEO. I really fell in love with Patagonia doing this research, is we're going to run out of virgin materials at some point. And depending on which supply chain you're looking at, you have a different view. And in the report, I didn't only limit our research to one supply chain. We looked at both the food supply chain with food origin. We looked at raw materials, which included oil and gas, or cobalt from pit mines or grain coming across Canadian-US border. And we also did a touch into pharmaceutical supply chain. The thing that's really exciting about pharmaceutical supply chain is really on the leading edge of what this technology can do, because there are so many regulations that you have to follow those regulations. And so economically, it makes sense for pharmaceutical to use a lot of these new ideas, which otherwise it doesn't make sense to apply them to some of the other supply chains that aren't necessarily requiring it at this point. So one of the phrases that we have in the foresight community is the future is unevenly distributed and you will see pockets of the future in the present. And so a lot of the things that pharmaceutical is doing and learning and innovating are opportunities for us to apply broadly across the supply chain in the future. I want to just, you know, there's a lot of data in this report, and so I'm not going to really touch on it too much. If you've read the report and you have questions, I will take questions. If you download and read the report and you have questions, I'm open to have more conversations about it. But I wanted to kind of introduce a couple of these sections to help you navigate them and figure out which ones it makes sense, because, I mean, tried to write this report so it was attractive and appealing and keeping your attention, but it also does, I don't know. I know not everyone likes to read like 50 to 100 page reports. I do. So this section really goes into, we did like an overview of some of the existing tracking technology and the state of it and how it's been used and the life. So, you know, we put this chart together to really like help us kind of navigate what are the different types of technologies that are being used for some of these, identifiers in different ways. There's a lot of innovation in this space, but there's no real one winner. We do talk a bit about distributed data structures. Myself and the other researcher who primarily worked on this, we do actively work in the decentralized identifier and verifiable credential community. So we're very familiar how to use DIDs and VCs and blockchain. And so we do go into some of the details of how this could be used. We talk about the data infrastructure and the data linkages and how to store and share that data and how does that connect back with IoT sensors. Who owns the data? Who has access to the data? These are things that we need to think about. That people are working on. One of the things that's really important was data harmonization. I was talking to a customs broker who dealt with a lot of grain shipments and other kinds of like raw material shipments across the US Canadian border. And one of the things that was really interesting to me is like the broker aggregates like all those kind of raw data points. So basically it's like the broker collecting this in the broker system and verifying that it is what this data is and then sending that data along with the shipment of the, you know, the soybeans or the grain or the corn or sides of beef coming across Canada into the US to be processed into foods and things like that. And not only does the broker have to certify this information for it to continue going to these factories and other things, but it also needs to provide this information to government agencies as well. And so here we have, an individual, an entity that needs to collect that data, certify it, verify it, and then pass it on and make it shareable. Did a little bit of a deep dive into GS1 and GS1 identifiers and how it is both like nested identifiers. And again, like when we talk about IoT and supply chain, thinking about things in kind of this way, we're talking about the identity of a lot of things very quickly and the data associated with those things. Let's see, what else do I have here? Okay. Let me jump ahead. Oh, this might be interesting. We did do research into technology platforms doing things in this space. This was a bit of a challenge in the research because not all of the platforms have a lot of information available. And sometimes it's hard to tell whether it's vaporware or they're just in stealth. So we did put together an overview of what we found and that we thought were interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening in the space. And I definitely have my favorites. These were the four market gaps from the NPE report that we felt were applied to this. It wasn't just this tracking and auditing goods in the supply chain. It also had to do with the legal identity, the authentication, so we can trust the sensor, and so we can also trust the data coming off the sensor. And then, I always like to look at what are systemic problems and what are potential opportunities or solutions to them. And so I'll pop over here because it's a little bit larger, but, you know, I already mentioned the many jurisdictions. One of my favorite innovations, this whole idea of persistent identifiers, I don't think it's going to be easy and simple to come up with them, but that's an area that I would love to do more work or collaborate with people doing research and brainstorming on what could a persistent identifier be? How could it apply within the various different supply chains?
Do you have an example of one?
A persistent identifier?
Yeah.
One interesting one that I came across was dust.
Diamond dust?
Yeah, you know, dust identity. They're trying to put something on, on a physical object. Another persistent identifier had to do with, did I have something here? Oh, here we go. I think, there's some really interesting possibilities for persistent identifiers, but I didn't see any silver bullet because there's a lot of different supply chains. I think probably some of the best ones are in the pharmaceutical supply chain with like QR codes that are, put on the boxes of pharmaceuticals and seals, which, I mean, those are not very, they are elegant, but at the same time, they're not like using crazy new technologies. So this was actually an area that, coming up with these recommendations, that comes like in the very end of the analysis of this research. This was actually one of the things that I would love to run like a foresight workshop, half day workshop with various industry folks and run through my foresight protocol to brainstorm what this could be, because I do think this is an opportunity for some real innovation. I'm sure there are people with different perspectives on this call or, in the industry where we would just find some very interesting things. I couldn't tell you what that is, but I know my process and my methodology. I have done that for other things, other industries before. And this was definitely one of the opportunities where I was like, I would really love to explore more moving forward. Okay. So that's not a very good answer. But I think, I don't have the answer for you, but because I also believe that these types of industry-wide solutions should come from an industry/community, right? Like no one person's going to have like the idea that solves everything. There's no Steve Jobs of persistent identifiers. Part of that is because there's so many different aspects and businesses and ways you want to slice and dice participants in the supply chain. So I think we need to have stakeholders from a lot of those different areas to really understand those things.
Just a heads up, we have about 5 minutes left.
Cool.
Hey, real fast, this is Tom Klein. At the Hyperledger forum, there was some quantum dots folks, so that would probably be another example of a persistent identifier where they put a chemical alteration into the product and you can track it.
Yeah, you're right. I did come across that too.
It was pretty early. It was pretty early, like you're saying.
And there's also been some stuff that has to do with fabric related, like in the apparel, that kind of thing.
Alicia, there's actually a company that I advise. They're out of Ireland, and they embed data into DNA, and then that can become an identifier as well. They're doing great work with that.
Oh, okay, cool. I think we came across some of that stuff too. I'm not sure how much was publicly available when we were doing the analysis of this stuff.
I can send you an email with the link later.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great. Okay, so I think the last thing I'd love to just touch base with you about that might be interesting is, since I am a futurist, I went ahead and put together some scenarios of the future. These really had to do with some data standards to make data more interoperable, to make digital twins more automatic and, have that data be accessible throughout the supply chain or have certain aspects or parts of that data pieces of the data available to different participants in the supply chain. A persistent identifier that could enable a circular supply chain. This also has an environmental impact as well. Using decentralized identifiers and other things to create a data grid where you can share data. And an area that I've become more interested in since this report was completed and released is Industry 4.0, which is applying a lot of these ideas in an automated industry. And Europe seems to be leading the way in a lot of that kind of stuff. From the economic perspective, wanting to connect the downstream sales with the upstream producers of the raw material. This is really to just have more economic stability, utilizing smart contracts and power grids. Recommendations in the report. And again, like this report was done for DHS because they were interested in the state of the industry and what's possible. And the ways that this is used with them is for them to invest in companies that are filling some of these gaps or solving some of these things. And the gentleman who did this research, this research award came under him. He moved over to the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, and he's funded various companies that are addressing various supply chain aspects through the Silicon Valley Innovation Program. His name is Anil John, and I'm happy to do that too. I think that's it. I threw in some slides about decentralized identity, like, because that's kind of some of the technology we're kind of thinking about. I think about what future identity system could look like. The way that we develop a new, or we iterate on our existing system is by having diverse viewpoints and having different data points. And so that's what this report really was looking to do, was to provide and share, you know, the knowledge from the research that we did. So, and I kind of came into this community after I had already written this report and finished this work. A little bit of missed opportunity, I think, to have a deeper participation earlier on. But at that point, I felt like, oh, I think you guys might find this very interesting. So we don't have very much time, but I'm happy to take questions now. And also, you're welcome to contact me. I'm very easily contactable. If you've got questions with or you want to dig into any of the research, or you want to collaborate in any way.
All right.
Any comments or questions or anything?
This is very good. Thank you. I joined late, but very good. Some good ideas here. And this is Tom Klein. I'll be sending a couple of emails here. I was just on a, right beforehand, Blockchain and Transport Alliance, and we were talking all about data industry standards.
Great.
Because there's so many different standards out there. BIT is trying to do their own work. There's the GS1 that you mentioned, OSS, found another one that came up on there on the session, and one guy was really pushing E3.org, or EDI3.org, which I've never heard before.
I think the right way to go about this is not this idea. And anytime you do a technology transfer in, and by technology transfer, I mean like you're transferring from an old technology to a new technology, like evolution is a lot of technology visionaries sell the vision of the end product, the end vision of the new technology, when the reality is we're like just very at the very baby steps, and it barely does any of the stuff that you're telling it to do. And so you really need to navigate that gap between the full evolution of the existing technology and where this new technology can go. And
the devil's in that detail, in that navigation.
Yeah, and so you need to make sure that you are able to interoperate and work in an environment where you're going to have a lot of legacy stuff, and you're going to have to, you know, interact with a lot of legacy stuff while enabling all these awesome new future possibilities.
Yeah. Good. Thanks for sharing here.
Great. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate your guys' attention, especially in the current state of the world.
Thank you. Thanks.